You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 277, Exodus 14, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. What's going on?
Well, we're still, again, believe it or not, early as it is, we are going through stuff and packing. So we're going to be in that mode for 6 months. You know, what can I say?
Oh, yeah, I hear you. It's the worst, too. Absolute worst.
It is.
And of course, me being a bigger guy and having a pickup truck, everybody asked me for help. And I finally reached a point where I just told people I'm out. You know, I've just... Stop asking me because my services are shut down. I don't know what age. It's as I got older, right? Of course, but my back.
Well, you could wear a knee brace, you know, just point to your knee brace, you know, and say, sorry.
Sorry. Workers' comp. I'm out. Just find somebody else. It's called get a U-Haul, you know, and get somebody else.
Well, you've got a knee issue. I'm surprised you haven't said that already, but.
Well, I mean, this is.
Just gritting through it. Younger.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't done it recently. I'm just saying. Many years ago when I was still moving eligible, I guess, but I had to shut that down and just said, look, people, we're at an age now. We're at an age now where you can afford to hire movers. And trust me, just hiring professional movers will take the stress off because that is one of the most stressful things.
No, we're going to do that. Every move, including getting here, it has been me, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm done with that now. Not for this one.
I hear you.
Well, yeah, I'm a little smarter now, I guess. It's been beaten out of me.
So moving, are we going to get to move the people through the Red Sea yet? Are we there? Are we actually?
Yeah, well, you know, we got chapter 15 next time too, but there's just isolated things in there. That's not going to be all about the crossing. So I think we're done with the crossing after today, and this is just going to be a different perspective on it. You know, this would have been a little too long to tack on to part one or what we already did. So we're calling this part two, but this is just a different perspective. And I wanted to include this because I'm guessing it'll probably be new to just about everybody. But it's kind of interesting too. So yeah, I can promise you we're not going to be doing crossing stuff proper after today. So does that make you happy?
It makes me happy. Absolutely. I'm enjoying Exodus. Yeah,
you like to keep moving. I know.
This is so long. There's so many, you know, when Exodus 1, I'm like, there's 2019, but that's okay. You know?
Well, you know, you be careful what you ask for. That's the answer now.
I think I voted for Exodus.
Yeah, what can I say?
I got it.
All right. Well, the other one was longer. I mean, it was Jeremiah. That would have been longer. So, what a relief. But
and the other one was eschatology, which would have been the shortest of all time because it would have been half an episode for you.
But perhaps the most torturous for me anyway.
Well, people did speculate. Well, he's already got a bunch of stuff out there in eschatology stuff. But you intended to add new information on top of what you've already produced out there, correct?
Yeah, but that spasm has passed, so I wouldn't expect that anytime soon. I actually have ideas on what to do after we're done with this that I think people will like, and it'll contribute to other things I'll be working on too.
Can
so
we get a teaser?
I already have a game plan.
Oh, okay. Is there a hint?
No, I'm not going to say anything beyond that.
Okay.
I'm just going to shut up.
Okay. Actually, you told me off air, and it's pretty exciting. So, audience, I'm going to say that much. So, hey, you're going to want to stay listening to the Naked Bible Podcast for a while. Because,
but was I telling you the truth? Was I telling you the
well? You're not a liar, are you? I certainly hope you're not a liar. So, I'm going to have to take you for your word for it. So, it's good stuff.
People tricked me into giving you the information.
It is good stuff. So, let me tell you, you're going to want to stick around to the Naked Bible Podcast. So, all right, that's all I'm going to say about that. But All right.
Well, let's jump into part two. Again, this is just sort of, it's going to be supplemental, but it's going to be new stuff. So, you know, now I'm tempted to say, this is kind of like what Trey and I were talking about off the air, like, you know, taking something familiar and then adding new stuff to it. So I don't know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But I think, you know, I wanted to add this because it's something that I've come across in the past. and I find really interesting, again, a way to sort of just look at what's a real familiar story from a different but related, angle. So in part one, and again, if you haven't listened to part one, it's not like you have to listen to part one for this, but I'd still recommend you do that. In part one, we talked, we focused kind of on the Yam Suf problem, the Sea of Reeds, or Red Sea problem. Like, what does that phrase mean? Why do we have a sea and a Red Sea that are separate but yet the same? And, all that kind of stuff. And that problem is linked to ambiguities in, physical place names in Exodus 14, in the itinerary, the narrative, and other passages, namely Numbers 33 is the other big one. So that's what we spent our time on last time. It's sort of the physical geography and its ambiguities and its problems. So this time, though, I want to look at the Exodus event broadly from a cosmic geographical perspective, mostly from the way an Egyptian would be thinking. And then, kind of, again, how the writer, who I would think certainly if there's mosaic material here, and I'm certainly not opposed to that. I'm not a, like I've said many times before, I'm not a Moses wrote every word of the Torah person, but I'm not a JEDPer either. And I don't see any specific impediment, that we couldn't have a mosaic hand in lots of places in the Pentateuch. If it was, then the Egyptian connection is obvious. Even if it's not, this is just going to be part of the larger Egyptian worldview that, would have been known in the broader ancient Near East among people who could write, the literate class, the scribal class. So I want to get into, again, how the Egyptians essentially sort of looked at their world and the way they viewed the relationship of their gods, specifically solar deities, to that world, and then how that sort of informs or could possibly inform reading the Exodus crossing, again, just like the plagues, as a theological polemic. Now, Hebrew Bible scholars occasionally traverse into this territory. It is not frequent, though. The first place I ran into this was a Journal of Biblical Literature article that was republished in a book by Bernard Batto. That's B-A-T-T-O. And it was entitled The Reed Sea. I've never had Latin here, so I might butcher this for someone who has had Latin, but the Requiescat in Pace, it's sort of Latin, I think, for rest in peace. So like he's putting this to rest. And Batto takes a skeptical view about, this actually being a literal historical event. And he sees this chapter and the whole episode as sort of historicized mythology or theology. In other words, it's a theological polemic only. It has no bearing on historicity. Of course, that is not, my view and the view of many others. But that's where Batto's coming from. Nevertheless, this was a really interesting article. I'm not going to, necessarily agree with all of what Batto said. And Hoffmeyer, who we referenced a lot in part one, does interact briefly with Batto. It's one of the few times I've seen Batto's work referenced in studies on Exodus. But I found it really interesting. And that's going to be the first sort of foray into this. We're going to talk about Batto's thesis a little bit. And then we're going to transition to something more recent. Batto's article was in 1983, so it's over 30 years old. And this idea that I'm going to describe that he writes about wasn't original to him either. He actually picks up on some things from a 1965 article by Snaith, and S-N-A-I-T-H, the Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds, the Red Sea. That was in Vetus Testamentum. Batto's article was in Journal of Biblical Literature, again in 1983. So this has been around for a while, but it's just not referenced very much. Now, what Batto does, and Snaith before him, again, to a certain extent, the argument is that the word suf, Yam Suf, okay, which we've talked about extensively here, should not be read as Yam Suf, but it should instead be read as Yam Sof. Okay, that would be a different word in Hebrew. You have to recall, Hebrew, again, has no vowels. Originally, it used certain consonants to mark vowel sounds. One of those consonants is the vav, which can be the vowel u or the vowel o. Okay, so Yam Suf or Yam Sof. Everybody takes it as Yam Suf, but Batto again, following Snaith, had this idea that, well, you know, maybe we've been misreading this. Maybe it said we should be vocalizing it Yom Sof. And the word Sof means end. So it would be the sea at the end of the land, or the sea which is at the end. Again, if images of, I don't know, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you know, with Reepicheep the Mouse and Aslan, you know, the sea that's at the end, you know, of all things. And then, you know, there's this transition to, I guess, the eternal state in Narnian, you know, thinking. This is kind of the idea cosmically that the Egyptians looked at their land as being, again, special. It was Egypt. Everything else was the wild place, uncivilized, you know, just, you know, chaotic mess. And the wonder that was Egypt is something that is special. It's under the dominion of Egypt's gods. It's the place they want to live. It's not that they don't rule elsewhere, as we're going to find out. The Egyptians thought they ruled basically anything they could see. But, you know, Egypt was special. It was a divine land, again. And so when you crossed the border, when you left Egypt at this, you know, we talked about in part one, this body of water that extended, one of these lakes that extended from the Gulf of Suez, the left prong of the Red Sea, you were leaving this wonderful place and you were moving past the sea, which is at the end, you know, the border, and you're moving off into chaos. So there's a cosmic concept here. Now, you know, this is consistent with, you know, Hofmeyer's notion that you have this string of lakes, you know, that marks Egypt's, you know, eastern border and all that. So this isn't different in that respect, but sort of how it would have been perceived is what's different. You know, Bato, you know, by arguing this, you know, he wants to say, well, the story is what it is just because, you know, you have this notion. We don't have a literal, you know, crossing of the sea. We don't have a miracle here. But what we have is we have a bunch of, you know, vagabond Israelites leaving Egypt. And you know, it's this, they're going off into cosmic chaos, you know, that kind of thing. So he tries to develop the content of the chapter along these, you know, mytho-cosmic themes, okay? That's what he's trying to do. Now, you might say, well, is there any real justification for this? You know, one of the places that Bato picks up on, he suggests that, you know, at least one of the Septuagint translators, you know, whoever the guy was that was assigned to Exodus, or maybe there was more than one guy assigned to Exodus, you know, he's going to translate it one way, and then there are going to be other guys that are translating other parts where Yom Suf occurs. And whoever had 1 Kings 19:26, okay, in Greek, it actually translates what we would think of as Yom Suf. It translates it as though it was Yom Sof. It really does that. It translates the phrase in Greek as eskates thalasses, the end of the sea, or the edge of the sea. You could even translate it the end sea. The Greek word for red, there are several of them, erythros, purakes, poros. Those aren't used in 1 Kings 19:26. Now, erythros is used elsewhere for Yom Suf, Red Sea. You know, and also, if you're paying attention, the Septuagint translator did not translate it Sea of Reeds. He didn't use the Greek word for reeds either. They do use the color red, Red Sea, or here in 1 Kings 19:26, the sea at the end. So Bato, you know, looks at this and at this one place in the Septuagint and says, you know, that's an interesting idea. Maybe that's the way we should look at this phrase everywhere, you know, that's associated with this episode in biblical history. Maybe that's what we should do. And you might be wondering at this point where the sea got its name, because if the Septuagint translator does in fact use the Greek word, one of the Greek words for the color red, so that, you know, there had to be somebody in antiquity that would call this body of water the Red Sea. If you're wondering, you know, who was the first person to do that, nobody really knows, and some have theorized that the name comes from the fact that Edom, okay, the you know, the people group, the place of Edom, controlled the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is the point of reference in 1 Kings, you know, elsewhere, when it mentions the Red Sea. So Edom was associated with red dirt. Okay, if you look at pictures of Edom, if you Google eat them, like red clay, red, you know, red soil, red dirt, you're going to see that a lot of the country is reddish in color. And since they once had control over one of these tips, somebody, you know, people have theorized, well, maybe that's where it got its name. It was the sea that the Edomites control, the Red Sea, you know, just sort of playing off the color of the Edomite land. And of course, Edom with Seir and, you know, Esau, you know, being the forefather of the Edomites, Esau was hairy and red, you know, all these sort of associations. So, you know, nobody really knows for sure why it got its name. But again, in Greek, the word for the color red is used of sea. But in this one place that Bato, you know, seizes on, or at least offers, you know, by way of a defense of his suggestion, we have this sea at the end. So again, he uses this to argue for a historicized myth in Exodus 14. You know, again, he's not looking for any historicity here. The Israelites, again, they leave Egypt. They move out farther than the eastern delta border, a border which is marked, again, by the Gulf of Suez and its canals, just like we discussed in part one. They leave, you know, this wonderful paradise of Egypt. They venture out into the chaos of the wilderness. So it's like this you know, mythic voyage into the unknown, you know, that sort of thing. So that's it. You know, that's how he takes this one nugget and he starts thinking about mytho-cosmic associations with land. Just to comment on Bato, I mean, actually you could say the opposite too, that the meaning of the cosmic geography would be more compelling if they actually did pass through a body of water at the border. If it really was conceived of as the sea of the end, this thing that sort of prevents icky foreigners, you know, from getting into Egypt, or, you know, if this thing, you know, sort of marks the gateway into this wonderful realm of the gods, you know, that called Egypt. Well, to basically have a foreign deity, Yahweh, just split that thing right down the middle and you walk over it like on dry land, that would be pretty dramatic. That would basically establish, well, who's really in control here? And you might be fearing the lands beyond Egypt, but you really ought to fear the God, you know, who has dominion, you know, of this place called Canaan, which is eventually where they're going to go. But that same God is in control of your lands as well. I mean, that would speak a lot more loudly if, you know, we didn't divorce, you know, the historicity, you know, from the episode. But again, I mean, you could say that. You could look at what Bato's doing and say that. So I just wanted to make that point. Now, Hofmeyr ultimately in his book rejects the idea that Bato's putting out, you know, the sea at the end. And he largely does so because of the inconsistency of the Septuagint. I mean, we really only have this one place, you know, where it looks like the translator saw the Hebrew text and thought Yom Sov, sea at the end. You know, so not much has been really made of this. So let's segue into some more recent work, though. I mean, Bato's observation is interesting. You know, there might be something going on there, you know, see at the end, even though you would think if that's the way a lot of people thought about it, you would at least get it a few more times in the Septuagint. Again, so, you know, Hofmeyr's criticism is legitimate, you know, but there are other ways to look at you know, the cosmic geography here that don't have anything to do with the phrase Yom Suf or Yom Sof. And I'm going to reference two articles here, and I've uploaded these into the protected folder in case anybody is interested. Yes, you know, it's going to be peppered with hieroglyphs and all this stuff, but he transliterates everything. And again, you can still get something out of both of these works. But they're both by the same guy. And I've actually referenced his dissertation in an earlier episode on chronology. But the name is Julien Cooper. That's J-U-L-I-E-N. And one of the articles is entitled The Geographic and Cosmogeographic Expression. And this is an Egyptian phrase, Ta Necher. And that's from the Bulletin of the Australian Center for Egyptology, Volume 22. That's a 2011 publication. And then 6 years later, the same author wrote a second article. And again, this one's in the protected folder as well. It's called Between This World and the Duat. That's another Egyptian term, basically for the netherworld. Between This World and the Duat, the Land of Wetenet, an Egyptian cosmogeography or cosmography of the Red Sea. And that's from a book. It's not from a journal. The book is called The Cultural Manifestations of Religious Experience, Studies in Honor of Boyo Akinge, who was a pretty well-known Egyptologist. And that's 2017. So I want to spend most of the time on the first one here, this phrase, Ta-Netcher, which shows up a good deal in Egyptian texts. And there's been, if you get Cooper's article, the 2011 one, and you read through it, he gives you sort of the whole history of scholarship here on the work that's been done. But I'm going to read, again, some excerpts from Cooper's article on Ta-Netcher. Like, what does that mean? Because it is connected to the Sinai and the Red Sea and a few other things. He writes, the Egyptian expression Ta-Netcher, which means the God, or God's land, G-O-D apostrophe S. So the land of some particular God. We'll talk about who that might be in a bit. The Egyptian expression Ta-Netcher, or God's land, is an enigmatic geographic phrase which represents a particular conception of the geography to the east of Egypt. Okay, there's that ties in with what we're talking about here, the eastern border, east of Egypt. This toponym, or place name, is an exceptional label in Egyptian geographic and cosmographic terminology, as it amalgamates two basic ideas, that of a deity, Netcher, and the earthly concept of land, Ta-Netcher, okay, the land of the god, the god's land. The presence of Kaset, the Kaset classifier. Now, again, just let me comment on what he means here. Hieroglyphic Egyptian is a pseudo-alphabetic language. You've got certain hieroglyphs that make one sound like an alphabet. You've got a few hundred that make two sounds or three sounds. And you also have hieroglyphs that don't make any sound. They are like cheat, little cheat hieroglyphs. A scribe would use a hieroglyph at the end of a word to classify it. They're called determinatives. So if you had an Egyptian word and your little determinative was a picture of a guy with his hand to his mouth, then that's the scribe's way of telling you, well, this word has something to do maybe with speaking or eating, something like that. So Egyptian would use hieroglyphs to classify terms, which are really helpful when you're trying to learn vocabulary and things like that. It kind of helps you cheat a little bit. Well, Cooper says the presence, when you get Ta-Netcher, there is something called the Kaset classifier, determinative is used. It's like a hilly horizon, and it means foreign land. So it classifies Ta-Netcher as being some geographic place outside of Egypt, right? And he says this determines the phrase, that the phrase indicates an expression that is the label for a unit of space outside the Nile Valley. Continuing with Cooper, he writes, the debates surrounding this toponym, Ta-Netcher, as in all studies of ancient toponymy, usually center around two important lines of inquiry. The most common is the debate of localization, that is, the precise location or area a toponym refers to. The other, no less important debate, is that of semantics, namely what the toponym means in an etymological sense, but also what it means to the contemporary culture. As Ta-Netcher clearly communicates a theological conception of geography, it is important that the religious implications of this word be studied, particularly the identity of the deity in question, and what is exactly meant by a land of the god, or the god's land. And he writes, this article presents the results of textual lexicographic study of all the documents from the Old Kingdom, that's the Pyramid Age, till the end of the New Kingdom, which contain the phrase Ta-Netcher. So this is a pretty thorough article. It's not hugely long, but it's very thorough. And as far as what his conclusions are, I'm just going to read you a few snippets of what he discovers. So he writes, numerous texts associate Ta-Netcher with toponyms in West Asia. That might be a foreign phrase. Let me just break in here. But Egyptians referred to people from Canaan or Palestine as Asiatics. So West Asia to an Egyptian is the landmass of Canaan and the landmass between, the forks of the Red Sea, the landmass that we call the Negev, all that stuff. It's not like China or something like that. So don't get thrown off by the term Asia. So back to Cooper. He says, numerous texts associate Ta-Netcher with toponyms in West Asia. These toponyms seem to cluster around northern Syria-Palestine, and are most commonly associated with texts narrating the procurement of ash wood. That's not ash like we think of, but it's an Egyptian term. So a particular kind of wood is where they would go to get it. The Middle Kingdom Wadi Hammamat inscription of Hennu mentioned above earlier in what he was writing also suggests that the Red Sea shore was part of Ta-Netcher, part of the god's land. Two inscriptions at Sarabit el-Qadem suggest that the Sinai Peninsula may also have been part of the God's land. Although Ta-Netcher is not geographically defined here, the association of God's land with the gemstone turquoise suggests that the Sinai was within the borders, the boundaries of God's land, again, this Ta-Netcher thing. From these sources, it is clear that the God's land then refers to a wide arc of lands which are east, northeast, and southeast of Egypt, including the eastern desert, Punt, and again, you know, this Asia, according to how the Egyptians would perceive this, stretching from the southern Red Sea to northern Syria. So basically, if you can think of a map of Egypt, you get out of the eastern delta, it's the Negev, it's Canaan, it's the Sinai Peninsula, all that to an Egyptian would have been the God's land. It's under the dominion of one of their deities. Okay. So they not only view their own place as sort of a cosmic location, but they have this also this concept that all this other stuff, especially, you know, moving out east, is under the dominion of, you know, one of their gods, or basically any solar deity, as we're going to find out. Now, that's interesting because, you know, of course, in the biblical storyline, none of that is the case. And in fact, the exact opposite is. This is where Yahweh is going to encounter the Israelites, certain patriarchs. Of course, there's a land of Canaan. So it's diametrically opposed to, you know, how an Israelite would look at things, really, you know, 180 degrees away. So a few more comments from Cooper, the cosmography of Ta-Netcher. And in this section of his article, he's talking about religious texts in particular. He said these religious texts use the God's land in this phrase, Ta-Netcher, in terms of cosmography. That is, how Egyptians map the general features of the universe, including heaven and earth, usually relating it to the solar cycle. Ta-Netcher is associated with the eastern horizon. Now, you should already be thinking about the sun. The sun rises in the east, okay? Ta-Netcher is associated with the eastern horizon and the home in Egyptian theology of the eastern souls. Again, this has something to do for an Egyptian with, you know, what happened during the sun. So let me just break in here. If the sun rises in the east every morning, and then it traverses the sky, goes through the sky, and you can see it. And then it descends, you know, on the opposite horizon. Okay, we talk about the sun going down. We know the sun isn't really going down, but this is the language we use, the ancients used. So it rises, goes across the sky, and then goes down, and everything becomes dark. Well, for an Egyptian, that meant that the deity, they looked at the sun as a deity, Ra, or again, they had different names, you know, for this, that the deity was entering the netherworld when everything went dark. And that doesn't mean that he was going to hell. It just meant he was going to the realm where the God normally lives, you know, the spiritual world. Then, you know, he's doing stuff over there. And then the next morning, he comes out of his domain, the domain of the spiritual world, and he traverses the sky again and keeps an eye on everything going on in Egypt and everywhere else. Okay? So when the sun rises to an Egyptian, it's leaving, the God is leaving the spiritual world. And so they also had this concept of the Eastern souls, basically those human souls that essentially get to live with the deity in the spiritual world. This, the East was where they were as well. So that's where you get this idea of the home of the Eastern souls. So back to Cooper, he says, this suggests a strong connection between the phrase Ta-Netcher, the God's land, and the phenomenon of sunrise. Taken together, all these assertions appear to confirm Kuntz's theory, and this is somebody he talked about earlier, that Ta-Netcher was, if not equivalent to, then strongly associated with, the eastern horizon. If you were standing in Egypt, this is me breaking in now, if you were standing in Egypt, you're looking to the east where the sun rises, you're going to notice something if you do it every day. You're going to notice that the sun rises a little bit differently, in a little bit different place every day. It seems to like move. And again, we know this because of, you know, the shape of the earth. The earth is round and it's tilted at an angle and the sun hits it differently. And you've got the equinoxes and all this kind of stuff. Again, to an Egyptian, it looked like the gateway, essentially, that the deity emerges from the spiritual world in the east, that it was really wide. I mean, it could range. This is why you have Ta-Netcher referred to all the way as north as Syria-Palestine, and all the way south as Punt, which is in Africa, you know, considerably a far ways down the Nile. Because again, if you were an Egyptian, and the priests did this sort of thing, they're the ones who wrote the religious texts. They're watching this, and there's movement, there's a range, you know, that of this gateway. And so their idea of Ta-Netjer, just to make it a summary here, is that all of the land, the physical land, that was sort of between the two far points, the northern point and the southern point, where the sun rises and it, you know, it moves back and forth. All of that was the god's land. That was under the dominion of the solar deity. Again, that was a place where he would come up and start inspecting things, you know, on Earth. And then at the end of the day, he would go back into the netherworld and then rise again the next day. So that's why you have this long, you know, swath of land that was perceived this way. Now, the motion of the sun across the horizon, you know, would explain why we get these sort of northern and southern extremes. As the sun god rose, again, at different points in the horizon between what we now know as the solstices, he would visit these regions. You know, he would be above Punt some days. He would be above, you know, Canaan some days. He would be above the Negev or Sinai or, you know, any of these places in between. He was visiting those places because he was their lord. You know, his home, you know, the place that he loved the most, of course, was Egypt, because this is where his incarnate son, in the form of Pharaoh, was put. You know, Egypt is the central axis from which from which Ma'at, earthly and cosmic order, was perpetuated. But the sun god, the sun deity, would visit other places too, because he was interested in them because they were his. It was the god's land. Now, what's really interesting is I'll put it this way. If you take the late date of the Exodus, that means the Exodus occurs after the Amarna period. Now, what you say, well, who cares about the Amarna period? The Amarna period was when Akhenaten was Pharaoh. And Akhenaten did away with a lot of the normal sun worship. He worshipped not Ra, okay, the sun god. He worshipped the Aten, which was the disk of the sun. He even changed his name, you know, to Akhenaten, okay? The last part of that name is Aten. So he was a worshiper of this the actual disk of the sun. That was his main deity. Now, people say, well, he was a monotheist. Well, yeah, he did have the names of other deities, you know, basically wherever he could get away with it, you know, erased from monuments and things like this. But he didn't. He also thought that he himself was a deity, so he's not, you know, is that really a monotheist or what? I mean, people bicker about this all the time. It's not the same as the biblical conception for sure, but this is where he was at. Now, when he dies, you know, he's anathematized by the Egyptians, and they restore. This is one of the reasons why King Tut, even though he died as a boy, was such a big deal, because Tut authorized the restoration back to the old religion, and he got rid of the Aten. He got rid of Atenism, the religion of Akhenaten. And so by the time you hit the Exodus, you know, later on, in the late date, you have Ra sort of back in place and as supreme. And it's really important to an Egyptian because he, you know, Ma'at has been restored now. You know, we had this burp, we had this awful period of you know, Akhenaten being on the throne, and it threw everything, the whole land, into chaos and all this kind of stuff. And he did, you know, he put the people in a lot of turmoil, because you don't just like change all the religion, you know, and just expect people to be happy with it. There were lots of people that weren't happy with it, and everything that you know, was bad that happened got blamed on this change, you know, this sort of thing. So when he's gone, Tut comes back, restores all the old ways, and everything's wonderful, because now we have cosmic order restored, and Ra is in his rightful place. You know, everything is the way it should be until Yahweh shows up. You know, so again, if you're a late dater, it sort of amps up the drama a little bit more, because now you have the God of the Hebrews showing up and basically giving all the, you know, a whole assortment of Egyptian deities, including Ra, a beating with the plagues, and basically saying, hey, guess what? this land over here, this is mine. In fact, I'm going to take my people out of Egypt. I'm going to take them across the desert. And you know what? We're not afraid at all of Ra. We're not afraid that he's going to interfere with us. Okay, Ra was just taught a lesson along with the rest of the Egyptian pantheon. So there's Yahweh out there leading his people, just going wherever he feels like, on the way to Sinai and then on the way to Canaan, without a care in the world. He's not afraid of Ra at all. I mean, this is how it would have been perceived. Well, we thought that was the God's land, you know, because that's where the sun rises and, you know, that's his turf. And we're not scared. We're not even giving him a second thought. Now, you can have that polemic if it's before the Amarna period as well. I mean, you don't lose anything with the early date. But if it is after the Amarna period, then we've got something, you know, fairly significant here. Where, you know, it just makes the confrontation a little more dramatic and a little more traumatic for an Egyptian, because you've just, you know, your country's just gone through this period that was just such a mess. You thought everything was restored, everything's the way it ought to be, and now we've got this. So again, they're just thinking about these places in these sorts of ways. Now back to Cooper, he says the term Ta Netcher most commonly occurs in sun hymns. That should be no surprise. Devoted to different solar deities like Ra, Amun-Ra, and Ra Harakhti, Ra of the horizon. That's what that phrase means, which strongly suggests an association with solar deities and this concept. When Ta-Netcher is connected with other deities, it is usually their solar manifestations which are evoked. So again, there's this solar connection. Mut is one where the name of Mut will be connected to Ta-Netcher, the god's land. But Mut is called the daughter of Ra and a manifestation of the sun disk in the crossword hymn. That's text 51 from this corpus that he's been using. The goddess Hathor, who is associated with some regions of God's land, is called the eye of Ra, the sun disk in God's land. In a Ptolemaic text, so Hathor gets into this too. In another text of this period, Horus as the god of the sky and the sun is called the one who assesses God's land. But again, there's a solar connection. So this has everything to do with where the sun rises. And again, this is how it would have been perceived. Basically, everywhere that the sun rises, everywhere that the light of the sun reaches, when the sun, you know, comes up every morning, that's the god's land. Which is a real broad statement of sovereignty, again, if you're an Egyptian. So again, it's pretty clear that Ta-Netcher was cosmic in the way it was thought of. All of these places, wherever the sun rises, essentially the sun is a theophany. Think of it as a theophany. The god has come out. He's emerged from his spiritual world, you know, the alternate reality, the spiritual reality, the reality of the divine, and he's surveying his land. And to an Egyptian, that meant dominion. That meant sovereignty. That meant control. That meant ownership. All these things. And when we have the episode with the Hebrews, those concepts just get, they just take a beating. Because you'd think if Ra is going to show up every day and he sees something he doesn't like going on, something that violates Ma'at, like these Hebrews, you know, doing what they're doing, and all these plagues and this guy Moses and all that, that Ra would do something about it. Well, that ain't going to happen. And when it doesn't happen, again, that's a theological statement to everybody who's, you know, who sort of knows the worldview. That's a theological statement that is pretty powerful for them. Now, from Cooper's other article, the Duat article, just one brief point from that one. He writes, the Egyptians considered the southeastern regions, specifically not only directionally associated with solar birth. Again, you know, the sun emerges, he's born. Like in Egyptian paintings, you'll have the sky, the sky goddess was Nut. Remember, the sun traverses the sky. You'll have Ra on his solar bark, his solar ship, traversing the sky, and the sky is this gigantic woman, you know, with stars and stuff, you know, on her. That was Nut. So the sun traverses, you know, Nut, and then goes, you know, down into the netherworld, and the sun emerges from, you know, I can't say it any other way, but from Nut gives birth to the sun. The sky gives birth. So where do you think the sun emerges in Egyptian painting? Well, you know, from the vaginal area. And this is what the Egyptian concept was, that the sky, again, is giving birth. And the birth canal essentially is is the, you know, the path of the sun. And so the imagery of Nut gets thrown into this as well. So Egyptians considered the sun being birthed from Nut and the region where the sun issues forth from the Duat, again, from the spiritual world. Cosmic theology, writes Cooper, provided a discourse in which Egyptians could speculate on the nature of not only the inaccessible universe, and the stars and the skies, the heavens, the gates of the netherworld, the gates of the Duat, but also they could speculate on the boundaries of the real universe where the Duat joined the terrestrial sphere, where heaven met earth. Where heaven met earth is where the sun emerges. And the sun emerges over the horizon, the eastern horizon. And during the course of the year, that horizon gets wider and wider because, again, of science that they don't particularly know, but they can track it. They can see it happening. They can see it happening. And so the place where heaven meets earth runs from Syria, North Syria, Palestine, all the way down to Punt. And that is the God's land that belongs to him. It's his domain. It's his doorstep. If you want to you know, use that as an analogy or a metaphor. And again, this is the very place where, you know, just think about what the Lord had told Moses to tell Pharaoh. You know, let my people go because we're going to go for a three-day journey out into the wilderness and they're going to sacrifice to me. Well, wait a minute. If you do that, you're sacrificing to Yahweh on the God's land. Yeah, we are. And again, that should make a point. So again, these are just examples of the way Egyptians and again Israelites familiar, you know, with the way Egyptians thought would have conceived, you know, some of this language, some of this dialogue and some of these events. So just to summarize the point, the Egyptians believed that Amun-Ra, you know, the solar deity, owned these lands, and they believed that the solar deity was reborn from these lands every day. These lands were the lands of his appearing. Again, so the sun is like a theophany to an Egyptian, an appearance of the deity himself. And these lands were the place where the spiritual world and the earthly world converged in that the solar deity emerged from them each day to survey the world that he owns, the world that he has dominion over. Now, we've already saw, if you think back to the episodes we did on the plagues, how the plague of locusts and its associated plague of darkness freaked the Egyptians out. That would have been directly seen as a power play of Yahweh over Ra because they couldn't see Ra. There's something wrong here. Why is Ra obscured? Why can't we see him? Why is there darkness? Why can't Ra get rid of these, you know, this thick cloud of locusts that are, you know, keeping us from seeing his glory? Why can't he do something about that? So those last two plagues, again, are an attack on Ra's power and sovereignty. And this whole concept as well. So the Israelites aren't just leaving Egypt, to an Egyptian especially. They're headed into lands that were thought to be under the dominion of Egypt's solar deity, Ra, or some of these other deities in their solar manifestation. But guess what? Yahweh is in control of the land where Israel has been. That would be Egypt. He certainly showed he was in control there with the plagues. And he's also in control of the land where they're going. He has dominion, not Ra. Yahweh and Israel, by extension, has no fear of going onto Ra's turf because Yahweh has ultimate sovereignty. They're going to go out into the desert and worship Yahweh at his mountain, and then the plan is to go to Yahweh's own land, Canaan. He'll lead Israel on whatever route he pleases. No permission is needed from Ra, and even more to the point, Yahweh has laid claim to part of the God's land, Canaan, because it isn't Ra's to claim. It was Yahweh back at Babel. Okay, think of your Deuteronomy 32 worldview here with, you know, the unseen realm and other stuff that I've written and, you know, stuff we talk about a lot. It was Yahweh who doled out the nations, Deuteronomy 32:8, and set their boundaries as a judgment. Okay, that was Yahweh who did that, not Ra. Ra has what he has because Yahweh lets him have it until he decides that he's done with that. Psalm 82. Again, to a literate Israelite reader, you know, once we have the text as we have it, someone who's familiar with the Egyptian worldview, someone who, you know, is boots on the ground, you know, when we have these sorts of things happening, just the act of leaving Egypt and going out into the desert to sacrifice to Yahweh is a punch in the theological face of Ra. Just that. because, again, of this concept of the God's land. So I wanted to include this in our treatment of Exodus 14. And it was too long to tack on to the first part. But again, if you're interested in some of this Egyptian stuff, you can look at the articles in the protected folder. But I, you know, this is the kind of stuff I just kind of like, because it sort of gets you in the head of more of the people that are involved in the story. In this case, namely the Egyptians. Like, what in the world are they thinking? Well, they were freaked out with the plagues, and this is just another episode of them being taught, or you know, sort of a visual aid to discerning who's really in control here. Again, it's the defeat of their gods, and specifically the most important one, you know, the solar deity, which, again, it's not just that the sun rises and sets every day, but that is connected to the annual flood of the Nile, which keeps Egypt alive. Okay, Egypt is not Egypt without calendar and the regularity of what happens with the Nile. It doesn't exist. It dies. So again, all these things are connected in the Egyptian mind, and they're connected to Ma'at, you know, the divine order that supposedly the Egyptian gods established. And that all just gets smashed in the Exodus episode. So again, I just wanted to tack this on, and hopefully it provides another perspective, a little bit of a different trajectory on the Exodus event. Next week, you know, we will get into Exodus 15. And like I said earlier, we're not going to traverse the event, you know, blow by blow again. But there are things in Exodus 15 that, again, you know, just provide a little bit of insight into cosmic geography, again, some of the worldview and how people are processing what's going on, both in terms of Israelites and Egyptians.
All right, Mike, we're making our slow, methodical march to the Ten Commandments. So that's next on my radar. All right. Yep,
there you go. Well, don't move the goalposts.
Sounds good. All right, Mike. Well, chapter 14, that's a wrap. So looking for chapter 15 next week. And then also in a couple of weeks, Mike, we're going to be interviewing Stovall Weems from Celebration Church.
Yep.
Get an update with what you're going to be doing and how that came about. Yep. And all that stuff. So be looking forward to that.
I think people will benefit from that. Like, what in the world's going on here?
Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.